Hey, I'm Josh Barrow, your new host of Left, Right, and Center. Every week, join Rich Lowry, Bob Scheer, and me for a contentious yet civilized debate of the week's big political stories, from ISIS to the U.S. economy to this 47-candidate presidential election we're having. You can find Left, Right, and Center on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
House Speaker John Boehner is stepping down. Hello again, I'm Aaron Olney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Yesterday, Pope Francis made history on Capitol Hill at John Boehner's invitation. Today, Boehner is making history of a different kind. He'll resign at the end of October to avoid what he calls the irreparable damage of leadership turmoil among House Republicans. We'll ask if a government shutdown over Planned Parenthood is more or less likely, and what this means for Tea Party power in Congress. In the second half of our program, two women have qualified as Army Rangers, but don't forget the Marines. The Pentagon's gender battle is not over. First, here's the news.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warman Olney, back with To the Point. The Army Rangers, the Navy SEALs, and the Marine Infantry are currently closed to women. The Pentagon has until next year to decide if it's time for a change. Despite recent performances by female soldiers, the Marine Corps Commandant and some members of Congress are pushing back against gender equality. First, this news update. After the Vice President, the House Speaker is next in line to be President of the United States. The speakership is the pinnacle of a politician's career. John Boehner, Republican of Ohio, has called it the job he'd always wanted. But today, Boehner announced he is resigning from Congress to avoid a battle over House leadership.
I've done everything I can over my term as Speaker to strengthen the institution. And frankly, my move today is another step in that effort to strengthen the institution.
Burgess Everett covers Congress for Politico. Good to have you back.
Hey, Warren. How are you?
Good. The speaker said today there would be irreparable damage from a prolonged leadership turmoil. Those were his words. What's he talking about?
He's talking about an attempt by one conservative member named Mark Meadows, but it has support of dozens of conservatives, that would essentially force a vote, a referendum on Boehner's speakership. They were thinking of bringing it up as soon as a government funding bill went through that did not speak to the Planned Parenthood videos that we've been hearing about for weeks now. So he was going to face a challenge to his leadership anyway, and he thought doing that would be too painful to put the House through with so many problems left to take care of this fall. So he figures a clean break is probably the more responsible thing to do as a speaker right now.
You mentioned the government funding bill at the White House during an appearance with the president of China. President Obama said that Boehner was a good man, despite their differences.
My hope is there's a recognition on the part of the next speaker, something I think John understood, even though at times it was challenging to bring his caucus along, that we can have significant differences on issues, but that doesn't mean you shut down the government.
Back to Burgess Everett. Is there now less of a risk of shutting down the government next week over Planned Parenthood?
Definitely, because there was a political calculation that if Boehner wanted to remain, he was going to have to make. The majority of his conference maybe was going to say, we should not do this clean funding bill. We should insist on defunding Planned Parenthood. And now Boehner doesn't have to choose between that and a government shutdown. He can put something on the floor that maybe passes with majority Democratic votes from Nancy Pelosi. And rather than getting criticism about his leadership, it just goes through as everyone kind of obsesses over who the next speaker is. So I think the government shutdown chances have really plunged, especially in the past 24 hours.
You mentioned Nancy Pelosi, the leader of the House Democrats, minority leader. Here's what she said.
That resignation of the Speaker is a stark indication of the disarray of the House Republicans, a demonstration of their obsession with shutting down government at the expense of women's health, and a sign of the failure of the House Republicans to be willing to engage in dialogue for the good of the American people.
So, Burgess Everett, the Republicans will still have a majority in the Congress. Who's likely to succeed John Boehner when he resigns just at the end of October? That's coming right up.
The obvious pick is going to be Kevin McCarthy from California, who's the majority leader and was previously the majority whip. He's basically from a new generation than Boehner. He's from came to Congress in 2007 as part of this Young Guns movement. He's recruited a lot of young Republicans. A lot of the freshmen and sophomore members kind of came up under him. And so he doesn't have that sort of experience that Boehner does, but he's probably more in step with his caucus. But the only problem there might be he's viewed not necessarily as the most conservative Republican. He's viewed as kind of a little bit of a moderate coming from California. So he's going to face a challenge of some sort. We expect him to run for the speaker, but there will be conservative opposition, and I don't know that he will have that much more sway over Republicans than Boehner did.
So McCarthy may then be the favorite, but we don't know that he'll be able to make it, or if he does, if he'll be able to rule the caucus any better than John Boehner.
Right. I mean, it kind of gives us a few weeks of peace as the government gets funded through December, but we're going to be right back in it no matter who the next speaker is. And I'm not convinced that the next speaker is going to have any more of a grip over the conference than Boehner has had.
The Congress, of course, will be in session all during next year when there is a presidential election campaign going on. Do you think that this will have an impact on that?
It's hard to say. I think the presidential candidates, especially the Republicans for the most part, are running against the GOP leadership in Washington. So whether it's John Boehner or Kevin McCarthy, I don't know that that changes that much. However, Boehner, he's recognized by more people. People talk about Boehner and McConnell, McConnell and Boehner. Those are the two names when you think about Republicans in Washington because they've ruled their caucuses for 10 years. So there's going to be some name recognition that they lose there. When you're trying to run against the Congress.
So then it may or not, may not then be an issue. Certainly, though, whoever the Democratic nominee is and the Democratic candidates in general will want to point to the problems that the Republicans are having, won't they?
Yes, definitely. And the I believe we're going to have at least one, if not more, kind of shutdown rattlings before November of 2016. Well, we're going to have one in December. We'll probably have at least one next year, if not more. So that's the kind of thing that the Democrats are going to be running against, saying you need to put us in the White House to have a more responsible vision.
Burgess Everett, covering Congress for Politico. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
In a moment, more of John Boehner's sudden resignation on To the Point from PRI.
Make a donation of just a dollar a day and you can join one of our exciting and exclusive angel clubs. Choose from music, books, DVDs, or cookbooks delivered right to your front door. Learn more and join now at kcrw.com/join.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Well, and only back with To the Point. Once again, John Boehner is stepping down at the end of October as House Speaker and as a member of Congress. His counterpart in the Senate, Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, praised Boehner for taking over at what McConnell called a very difficult time.
When some said Republicans could never recover, he never gave up. When some gave in to defeatism, he kept up the fight. And because he did, Speaker Boehner was able to transform a broken and dispirited Republican minority into the largest Republican majority since the 1920s.
Mitch McConnell, once again, speaking on the floor of the Senate today with music in the background. Steve Dace is a host of the conservative radio program, The Steve Dace Show. It's broadcast in Iowa. He's also a columnist for The Washington Times, a conservative paper in the nation's capital. Steve Dace, good to have you back on our program.
Thank you very much for having me. How are you?
Well, very well. Thanks. Do you agree with Mitch McConnell that that the speaker, who is now leaving, in fact, has a gets a lot of the credit for the fact that there's a majority of Republicans in the lower house?
I listened to that clip. I'm sorry I could not keep a straight face. That's why my mic was off. I was laughing. This is what John Boehner has done. He has, to use Mr. McConnell's words, he has managed to transform the Republican Party into a dispirited, divided, and completely disillusioned majority, the largest divided, disillusioned, dispirited majority in the Congress the party has ever had. And but he doesn't get all the credit for that. I mean, while we're, you know, dishing out the kudos here today, certainly Mr. McConnell gets more than his fair share.
So is this then a victory for the very conservative members of whom for whom you speak and who you agree with, that they knocked him off? Is that what they did?
Well, in a way, yes, but no. In the short term, what it means is that the Republican Party is finally admitting that it has a major base problem, something it has tried to ignore when it talks to mainstream media, when it's on television interviews, that this stuff is not really going on. And they finally are coming to grips with the fact that it has a major existential crisis on its hands. What it has not figured out yet, though, is if this is a temper tantrum by us in the base or if it's a paradigm shift. And I think this is a maneuver intent to buy time to figure that out, because this is a carefully plotted out plan. This is you look at the timing of his resignation. The end of October is not a coincidence. All of the major spending battles and fights are due to take place, including defunding Planned Parenthood, in October. So what will happen here is the Republicans already have, the leadership does, already has a preemptive plan to cave on everything. Boehner then, of course, the base will be, they'll be Spinal Tap, brother. They're going to turn that up to 11, whatever frustration level they have now when they see that. When the failure theater comes to a Cineplex near you here this October on an everyday basis, and after we get a look at that, Boehner will then fall on his sword, be the fall guy, and that also gives them a several-week notice to come up with who their successor is going to be, rather than a vote to vacate the chair, which sort of creates a free-for-all in a parliamentary fashion. So this is a carefully coordinated plot. The timing of this and his resignation is not, they didn't just, you know, pick that arbitrarily. They fully intend to cave on everything, and then Boehner will resign and fall on his sword.
What he's been saying all morning is that he did intend to resign last year. He decided after his majority leader lost an election in his Southern Virginia district, that he would stay on for the good of the institution. Now he says that he had planned to resign at the end of this year, but that he decided after seeing the Pope yesterday and getting up and saying his prayers this morning that he would go earlier rather than later, not insisting that this was not a long coordinated
I don't believe any of that. I think that's just all a bunch of lies.
Okay.
I can't imagine anybody's response to seeing their majority leader defeated in a primary is to come back the next day and say, well, I guess I should just stay longer and make even more people angrier. I mean, that's just not, I mean, we've got a saying back here in Iowa, don't pee on me and tell me it's raining.
Okay, so what some call a plan to cave, others call an opportunity to govern. David Korn is Washington Bureau Chief for Mother Jones, comes from the left side of the political spectrum. Good as always to have you on our program.
Good to be with you, Warren.
How do you respond to what we just heard from Steve Dace, and how do you see the Congress coming up in the next few months? Is it going to be as chaotic as he describes it? Could you at least agree on that?
Oh, I think it's going to be incredibly chaotic for the same reason that Boehner's leaving. The Republican Party is, you know, divided between, you know, maybe it's minority now, at least in Congress, of those who want to govern and who don't want to have throw tantrums and shut down the government, and those who want to blow Washington up. And I do think that the latter category is maybe closer, or at least has a lot of passion within the GOP base. That's one reason why Donald Trump is doing so well. But there's an NBC poll out today that says 72% of Republican primary voters want to see McConnell and Boehner go. They're getting their wish on Boehner. But 36% of them want to see both of these guys removed immediately. And so they don't want compromise. They want to shut down the government of a Planned Parenthood or whatever else. I mean, it used to be about Obamacare or immigration executive actions. I mean, it doesn't matter. They want to, you know, destroy any possibility of making divided government, which is what we have in Washington with a Democratic president, work. And Boehner has tried to, you know, keep things together for the last couple of years. I don't think he's always done a good job, but he hasn't been so much a leader as he's been a hostage. His number one priority seems to be preserving his own job. He couldn't get his Congress, you know, Republican Congress member to go along with his attempt to have a grand bargain with the president on taxes and government spending. He leaves behind no legislative accomplishments. And from maybe Steve's perspective, he's also failed to satisfy the GOP base. He can't stop Obamacare. He can't do what the base wants. He can't do what he wants, which maybe is to govern. So he is, he was always more of a sort of like an attendant rather than a leader as House Speaker.
David Korn, once again, Bureau Chief in Washington for Mother Jones Magazine. Thomas Mann is a veteran political reporter and columnist. He's now Senior Fellow at the Brookings Institution and resident scholar at UC Berkeley. And Tom Mann, good to have you back on our show as well.
Hi, Warren. Delighted to be back.
How many times has a speaker resigned from this extraordinarily important position, a third in line to be President of the United States?
Believe it or not, quite frequently. Remember, Newt Gingrich stepped down after the debacle of the 1998 midterm election. Jim Wright, charged with so-called corruption in a case waged by Newt Gingrich, resigned as well. Then you have to go back to far into the history to find other examples of it. What's unusual about this is this reflects, in my view, not any sort of personal failures on Boehner's part, but really reflects what's happened to the Republican Party in recent years. The party really has become an insurgency and has in mind big changes of cutting government down to size and taking steps on the social agenda that that would be really quite disruptive. And ironically, it was Boehner's fellow leaders, the young guns of Cantor and Paul Ryan and Kevin McCarthy, who encouraged the base to radicalize and encourage the Tea Party and told them if we get the majority board, we can really undo all this terrible stuff. Well, all you have to do is read the Constitution, see the separation of powers, realize the existence of the veto, and understand that's not how our system works.
Let me go back to Steve Dace, again, our conservative talk show from Iowa, columnist at The Washington Times. Do you think that the leadership then under the speaker, in fact, overpromised to people such as yourself who really want to see something much more radical happening in Washington than they're able to provide?
Well, I was just listening to my counterpart here from, is it the Brookings Institution, I believe?
Yes, and, Brookings and UC Berkeley.
Yeah, I appreciated his lecture on the separation of powers. I'm wondering if he has sent any of those similar thoughts to a president who likes to, on every given day, remind us he's got a phone and a pen and unilaterally make decrees and impose his fiat from on high and just decide what we have as a border, who becomes a citizen, strictly just based off, you know, what's on the top of his head after telling us 20 previous occasions as a supposed constitutional attorney he cannot do those things.
So you're telling us then that what the Republicans promised or what the Boehner leadership and the others promised was not overpromised at all, but that they should be able to kick the president around?
Yeah, they should be able to. They have power, too. I mean, kicking the president around, I wasn't aware that Congress's job was to get elected and be subservient to the president. The American people made a decision last November, and that was to have the fewest Democrats nationwide in the legislative branch than we have had in 86 years. And it certainly wasn't because of the dulcet tones and rhapsodic melodies of Ditch McConnell and John Boehner and the promises of Xanadu they promised to bring to America. It was completely a reaction to what they saw from Obamaism. So if they wanted more of the Obama agenda, I think everybody here that claims to have any semblance of common sense and a modicum of reasonableness would assume, therefore, that they would have voted in the president's party in power in order to continue to grease the skids for his thoughts. That's not what they did. They voted for the opposition in record droves. Guys, we have Republican governors in Maryland, Illinois right now, simultaneously for the first time since Ward was originally hard on the Beaver last night, 60-plus years. Now, why is that? Because of a reaction to what they've seen from this White House. Instead, I work for an organization called Conservative Review, and here's what we found. What we found is last year when the Republicans were in the Senate minority, they voted with Obama 54% of the time. This year, as the majority, the Republicans who returned from the last Congress to this one. So far this year, Republicans in the Senate have voted with Obama 55% of the time. They've actually sided with him a majority of the time and more than they did last year in the minority.
So, Thomas Mann, back to you. What does this say, this argument about the nature of government in Washington now? And are we at a kind of constitutional crisis?
Listen, the problem is that laws were enacted in Obama's first 2 years, and you can't nullify them because you win a midterm election majority after that. Obama was reelected. The reality is we are a constitutional system. Obama has 2 4-year terms, and winning a midterm election with a president of the other party in office does not give you the ability to undo what was duly passed, enacted by a previous Congress and signed into law. Warren, I think the problem is this. The parties differ by policy, to be sure, but mainly it's affective. Steve hates Democrats. He hates Obama. They are evil incarnate, and to do business with the enemy is a travesty in their mind and an abdication of responsibility. But our whole Madisonian system is predicated on the basis of trust, that people representing different constituencies and interests will accept the legitimacy of the others and come together and try to reach some accommodation.
Let me go back to David Korn. Excuse me for interrupting, but we're going to run short of time. David Korn, the Washington bureau chief for Mother Jones. Where do the Democrats come down in this? Will they be able to capitalize, do you think, on what Thomas Mann is saying? Or will the Republicans, as Steve Dace is suggesting, be able to finally win majorities in bigger majorities on the part of what he refers to as the base in both parties, both houses?
The question is whether the Tea Party takeover of the Republican Party is complete or not. We may see that with the GOP 2016 presidential primary or not. The content of Congress is not going to change for the next year. But in the meantime, you do have, Steve's base demanding that the Republicans shut down the government over Planned Parenthood. And this is going to be a fight that's going to come up in the next couple of weeks. And, Boehner, one reason he might have, announced his retirement now is so that he can put together a coalition of non-blow-it-up Republicans and Democrats to keep the government going, well, at least for...
So you agree then with Steve Dace that this was all planned in advance?
No, I'm not saying it was planned in advance, but I mean it could be that, looking at going through this again, Boehner would have to have made the decision that he's been faced with in the past,
okay,
to govern and put his speakership at risk, all to yield to the Tea Party fever.
Okay, that's all the time we have. I want to thank you all very much for being with us. We'll see what happens in the next few days. Again, David Korn with Mother Jones, Steve Dace, talk show host in Iowa, and a columnist for the Washington Times, Thomas Mann at the Brookings Institution and UC Berkeley. In a moment, despite the recent performances of women soldiers in training, the Pentagon's gender wars are by no means over. We'll talk about that in a moment on To the Point from PRI.
Are you thinking about buying a new car? Consider donating your old one to KCRW and support the unique mix of news, music, and culture you love. You'll become a KCRW member and get a nice tax write-off. For details, visit kcrw.com/cars.
We're not only back with To The Point. A couple of years ago, former Defense Secretary Leon Panetta ordered the Joint Chiefs to study the feasibility of opening all jobs in the military to women. He gave them until next year to make a decision. The current secretary, Ash Carter, will get recommendations next week from the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, and the Marines. Leo Shane is congressional reporter for the Military Times. Thanks so much for joining us.
No, thanks for the invite.
What exactly is it that the Pentagon has to decide?
Well, they have to decide whether or not they're going to leave some of these jobs open only to men and exclude women from them. You know, we've seen each of the services doing a pretty intensive review of all of their jobs, seeing which positions, which specialties are currently closed off to women, what the reasons were for that, whether or not those reasons are still valid, or if they're just leftover stereotypes from years and years ago.
There are those who say that what they're really talking about is whether they should open up combat roles to women, but it seems to me it's really more complicated than that.
Well, that's most of the sticking points. And what we've seen over the last couple of years is some of these positions, especially a lot of the Air Force positions where we've already seen some women fighter pilots, some other specialties that used to be closed. We've seen the services sort of say, all right, well, these are the obvious ones. These are some that just seem to be anachronism, seem to be left over. But the combat ones are the sticking point because they've traditionally been male only because they are a more complicated scenario than some of the other positions.
Isn't war, though, hasn't it changed sufficiently that women already, given how many positions they do hold in the service, are often involved in combat?
And this has been one of the cruxes of the argument. Back when we were talking Vietnam or World War II, there were clear front lines. There were your clear infantry soldiers who were at the front, who were in the majority of the fighting. What we saw in Iraq and Afghanistan was guerrilla warfare, IEDs. Folks in any portion of the military could end up in combat, and quite a few women did, and quite a few women performed admirably. Quite a few women were injured or killed. So the argument of supporters has been, look, women are already in combat. This is silly to have this conversation. What the opponents have thrown in opposition to that is, look, being in combat, being able to hold yourself in a single firefight is different than being in infantry units, different than long stretches embedded in dangerous areas. It's different than the close camaraderie that's needed, the lifestyle, the facilities that are needed for some of this frontline work.
What about the two women who recently passed all the necessary training to be Army Rangers? That's one of the special forces that has been excluded, there where women have been excluded.
Yeah, and since then we've gotten indications from the Special Forces commands, not just the Army Rangers, but the Navy SEALs, some of the other specialties there, that they'll be opening their classes, their specialties to women, with the caveat that they want to make sure that the standards remain the same. But what the opponents will argue is it's different for those folks. You're talking specialty units, and there are some units where if folks are going to be embedded in pretty rustic conditions for long periods of time, if they're going to require close quarters for long periods of time, it might not be suitable to have men and women in a mixed unit like that.
Leo Shane, again, congressional reporter for the Military Times. What about the senior leadership, civilian leadership of the Pentagon, Ash Carter and the various secretaries of the services? Where do they come down?
Well, so we've had a little bit of a spat recently with this. Secretary Mavis of the Navy came out very publicly and said he wouldn't be asking for any exemptions for any naval jobs, any naval specialties, and didn't expect the Marine Corps would need them either. That apparently came as news to the military leadership at the Marine Corps, who released a study saying they've seen evidence that mixed gender units aren't as effective as male-only units, at least when it comes to some infantry issues, and they would be asking for exemptions to keep women out of Marine infantry units. Now, that's created a little bit of a media fighting match between the Army and the Navy. The Navy and the Marine Corps folks. Since then, Secretary Carter stepped in and said, "Look, I want to look at everything, and I want to shut this down. I want to have these conversations behind closed doors and not out in the public." So as a result, the Army, which at first at least had indicated they were going to open up a lot of these jobs, is now officially quiet on what their recommendation will be next week.
Leo Shane, again, congressional reporter for the Military Times. Anna Simons is professor of defense analysis at the Naval Postgraduate School. Thank you very much for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
As I understand it, you are opposed to opening up these specialized roles to women. Is that because you don't think women have the physical or mental ability to handle them?
No, I believe there will always be some women who clearly are very physically capable, and certainly women have all sorts of mental capabilities and in some areas may actually excel. However, my argument has always had to do with the cohesion that's necessary in very small units that are autonomous for indefinite periods of time and where individuals really have to be all for one and one for all.
Elaborate a bit on what you mean.
When you're talking about, there's an anthropologist named Lionel Tiger who in the early 1970s coined the term male bonding. And everybody likes to pretend that male bonding is insignificant and doesn't matter. But even if you were to pretend that such a thing doesn't matter, I think every sentient adult who's honest about what they've experienced in life knows that when you put men and women together for extended periods of time, or not even for extended periods of time, if you put them together in the workplace, there's always the possibility or the potential for drama, not just shenanigans, but drama in terms of somebody's nose is out of joint because they're not getting enough attention, or there's favoritism. There's a dynamic that's involved when men and women are together that doesn't exist when you've only got men.
Again, Anna Simons is a professor at the Naval Postgraduate School. Ligia Zeruto is a combat veteran. She's also a major in the U.S. Army Reserves, and she is in the process of applying for the November Ranger School. Good to have you on our show. Thanks for joining us. Can you hear me? We seem to be having a problem with our transmission here, and we're trying very hard to get it together. Do you think then, Anna Simons, let me, as we try to get a hold of Ligia Zeruto, can you tell me, do you think that it's impossible for men and women to bond in the same way for the purposes of service in the small autonomous units that you described?
I don't think it's impossible, but I do think it's on a case-by-case basis, and the military is not designed to operate on a case-by-case basis. I mean, if it were, it would be a wonderful thing, and everybody would be in exactly the job and the role that they want to be in, and they would move on to the next job and role that they want to move on to, but that's not the design behind the military. Military is designed so that individuals are largely thought of as interchangeable, particularly in combat units where you're going to have attrition, you're going to have losses, and so you could have a woman who's bonded perfectly well with, let's just say, 11 guys on a special forces operational detachment, and she becomes a casualty for some reason. You then replace her. Do you replace her with another woman? Do you replace her with a man? Let's just say you replace her with a woman. The chemistry might be totally different. Arguably, you can say the same thing when you're talking about male replacements, but males know how to get along with other males in a very different way than they do when a woman is thrown into their midst.
Now we do have with us Ligia Zeruto, combat veteran, major in the U.S. Army Reserves, in the process of applying for Ranger training. Good to have you on our show. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, sir. Good to be here.
What do you say to what we just heard from Professor Simons about the bonding process that goes on, particularly in small units where a few people are together for a long period of time, and it really has to be one for all and all for one?
What I can say, and again, it's based on my experience, is that bonding tends to occur and has occurred in my history regardless of who was part of the team. What we all centered on was the mission, combat effectiveness, capability, and teamwork. And it didn't really matter whether you were a woman or a man. What mattered is that you were part of the United States Armed Services, and no branch mattered either.
So when the mission then is uppermost, you're suggesting that women can bond with men and vice versa?
Absolutely. And I do believe that some of what Ms. Simons might be talking about has to do, you know, generationally speaking, with how girls and boys are raised in the United States. And what I can offer you is that, again, in my experience, working alongside and serving alongside both infantrymen, tankers, pilots that come from what I would consider the millennial generation, do not see any problem or seem to have any problem with women being in, again, these small units. And secondarily, as long as the mission was accomplished, there was never a question about the gender of who was on the team.
What about your own situation? You are, if I can reveal this to our listeners, 39 years old, you have three kids and an active duty spouse. You still, however, want to have Ranger training. Tell us why.
I do, and it has a lot to do with the legacy of some of the leaders that I have served with in the Army, those who I had the most respect for, those who I followed into war. All had the crescent-shaped Ranger tab, and I know what the school is. I know what the school means. I know that the culture it creates when you have a Ranger-tabbed individual in your midst. It is, first and foremost, a leadership school, and it's, you know, studying the discipline of what the basis is of all of our service in the military, at least in the Army, and that is to be a soldier.
Let me go back to Professor Simons. Should women be denied that opportunity?
Well, let me just say a couple of things, if I can, before answering that. One, and I think that this is a great point that was just made, but listeners may not really be aware. The school, Ranger School, is very different from being able to serve in the Ranger Battalion, and Ranger Battalions remain all male units. There's also this business of bonding. So I would just throw out, you know, David Petraeus and Paula Broadwell certainly bonded, but perhaps not in the ways that we would wish.
She was the biographer of the general who, in fact, was not his wife, with whom he took up a relationship. Go ahead.
Yes, exactly. And then when it comes to millennials, I would just pitch back the study that came out this week that 1 out of 4, I mean, if you're looking at 18 to 22-year-olds and you look at the best educated, by definition, best educated 18 to 22-year-olds in the country are presumably kids who are in college. And they've got tremendous problems when they're living together, and they're not living together under the same conditions, same duress, same need for release from tension when you're talking about combat situations as young Marines or young soldiers.
So the bottom line then is you wouldn't have an objection to women going to the Ranger School. It's service in the units themselves that you're concerned about.
Yes, and then if I can add something else, I would also say that I don't know why proponents, I mean, this is one of the things I've been asking for the last decade plus. If proponents are really keen on women being able to live in foxholes and be able to take the fight to the enemy, sort of which requires relentless pursuit of the enemy, then why hasn't anybody advocated for all female units where women would have that opportunity?
Let me go back to Major Zeruto. What do you say to that?
Well, first off, for me, it all comes back to mission requirement and capability. So if there's a capability that an all-woman unit could offer that our military deemed appropriate, then I would advocate for that. But, you know, my question to Ms. Simons would be, you know, the studies that have come out, like for instance, your millennial study with the 1 in 4 rate, I'd be interested to study a mixed combat unit, which to my knowledge, at the units that we're talking about, infantry units, has never been done because it has never existed. Anecdotally, we can talk about relationships that were built and, you know, hone in on things that may or may not have been inappropriate. But what I think you might find is if you look at our military broad scale over the past decade and a half, mixed gender units in austere conditions under extreme duress have performed not only suitably but honorably and in a way that is with an integrity that all of us could be proud of and would expect in a combat fighting unit.
Let's get a long-term view of this from Philip Carter. He's director of the Military Veterans and Society Program at the Center for a New American Security. He himself is a veteran. And Philip Carter, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Warren.
Have there been mixed combat units in other countries, and have they been studied in the way that Major Zeruto thinks they should be?
Other countries, including U.S. allies like Israel, Norway, the U.K., and others, have employed women in frontline roles, not typically as infantry or special operations forces, but typically in combat support roles. By and large, those women have done well, but they've often done so in a very different social context. The Israeli context is instructive. There, women serve as conscripts, not volunteers. They serve in combat support roles very close to the front lines. But it's just a very different social context, and it's hard to relate that. That said, this has also been an ongoing U.S. experiment over the last 25 or 30 years, really going back to the invasion of Panama, the first Gulf War, the Balkans. This is not a new issue. Women have been in the military and have been in combat, just not in these particular jobs, in these particular units that are the subject of today's debate.
How different are those units from the ones in which women have, in fact, been assigned and performed well?
They are different, but in very subtle ways. There is a difference between seeing combat as a military police soldier driving up and down the roads, as I did in Iraq, hitting the occasional ambush and fighting through it, versus serving in the infantry, where your job is to day in, day out, carry heavy packs, move over long distances, fight at the end of a very long supply line, and do so in austere conditions. We have, on occasion, required women to serve alongside the infantry. The Marines employed women this way in Afghanistan. So, too, did the Army and Special Operations Forces. But it's been a very narrow set of cases. There is this difference between sort of doing it by exception when women see combat in support roles and doing it as a full-time occupation in the infantry when you're essentially signing up for a life of hardship and deprivation. And there's a very real difference for those involved regardless of their gender. The life of the infantry has been hard, and it's really been hard since time immemorial.
Philip Carter, once again, at the Center for a New American Security. We're going to take a very brief break, and we'll come back and return to this conversation in just a moment on To the Point from PRI.
KCRW's Eclectic 24 is our ever-expanding all-music stream, featuring the best new releases, classic favorites, and special features, including today's top tune, guest DJ project, and KCRW archives. Listen worldwide anytime online or through your iPhone or Android phone app. KCRW's Eclectic 24, where and when you want it. Check it out at kcrw.com/eclectic24.
Well, we're not only back with To the Point, talking today about a long-time controversy, which is coming to a head very soon with the heads of all four of the military services next week expected to report to the Secretary of Defense on what they think about opening all roles in the military to women. Leo Shane, once again, is congressional reporter for the Military Times. Pardon me. One congressman who has weighed in on this is a Republican from Oklahoma, Steve Russell, a former Marine himself, who has said that the Army, with regard to the training, excuse me, he was an Army Ranger, not a Marine, I beg your pardon, but he has said that when these two women who have been gotten so much publicity for getting through the Ranger school were going through that experience, they got special treatment and special training. Leo Shane, how solid is that accusation?
Well, this has been the concern and the accusation that lawmakers have been throwing around for several years now. The ones who are opposed to mixed gender units, and what they've said is, you know, inevitably, whatever your goal is, you're going to end up lowering standards. There's going to be a political correctness angle to this to make sure that women get in. Specifically, what Representative Russell has accused is that the Ranger School gave the women extra chances. He believes that there was some shenanigans with the standards that were set, and he has requested their test scores, a bunch of other documentation to prove that wasn't the case. Now the Army has been very adamant on this, and was adamant when the two women graduated from Ranger School. They said none of the standards were changed. The quote they keep pulling is the 5 mile run is still 5 miles, and that no special accommodations were made. These women lived up to the standards, and the other Ranger graduates echoed that when they were interviewed by press shortly after their graduation.
So let me go back to Anna Simons at the Naval Postgraduate School. Is that an issue that you're concerned about, or do you think that's been resolved, that they didn't, in fact, get different standards?
I think that as long as it's an issue in the minds of guys who are currently in the service, it's an issue, if that makes sense. In other words, there's this creeping doubt that's always there that the standards, because the standards do change over time, and the standards have been changed for a lot of these selection processes when numbers need to be increased or when there's been a political push one way or another. So I think the fear among many of those who are serving and many who have served is that even if the standards weren't changed in this particular case, the standards, if the decision is made to open everything up to women, that the standards are going to have to change in the future. And this really scares people.
Let me go back to Major Ligia Zeruto, once again, a combat veteran who wants to go to the Ranger School. I suppose that would be your worst nightmare.
Absolutely. And as a pre-Ranger candidate previously who's attended other pre-Ranger trainings, what I can tell you is that no standard was budged, and I went to several different pre-Ranger trainings at different posts with different organizations, all infantry organizations. I can also tell you that it's, in my mind, a little bit preposterous to question the integrity of the RIs, because what I see happening next is someone questioning the integrity of the investigation that may or may not come out of Congressman Russell's request.
Philip Carter, back to you with the Center for a New American Security. Once again, you've served with women in Iraq and elsewhere, and I'm wondering if you agree with the idea that there's always that doubt that somehow, because of political correctness, as Professor Simon suggested, or simply because of the stereotypes and that have existed in the past, that would always be a problem.
So it's interesting. This doubt is going to become particularly difficult in a peacetime army or a peacetime military where we're not going to have the crucible of combat, which itself imposes a universal standard that is immutable. And I think this is something the services are going to have to wrestle with. There is also, though, an easy answer to this, which is a single, high, uniformly enforced standard for men and women. Currently, four of the four services have gender-differentiated physical fitness tests. You have to run faster as a man to get the same score than you do as a woman, for example. That needs to go away. And so do a lot of other standards and programs where we differentiate between the genders. There ought to be one high standard for both. Many women will not meet that standard, but so will many men. And that is the point. We want a selective military that only has the best.
Major Zeruto, do you want to be challenged if and when you go to Ranger School with exactly the same standards as all the men?
Absolutely. I would have nothing else than that. And what I might add to the previous remark is that not only do we have differentiations in our physical fitness test by gender, we have it by age as well. So it might bring the question to bear, you know, do older service members have a place in our military? Can a 45-year-old male infantryman run as fast as an 18-year-old infantryman? And if not, do they have a place? I feel like, you know, if we're going to delve into the capabilities by gender, let's also talk about the age situation as well.
What about prior injuries? It's my understanding that one of the things that delayed your application for Ranger School is you got a concussion.
I did. And I think what I've seen certainly in reporting is that women are injured more frequently than maybe men are. I think also what it comes down to is that women more frequently report than some of our male service members. And I think that that's also, a societal circumstance as well.
Leo Shane, back to you with the Military Times. We heard that some Congress members are opposed to this. Tell us which Congress members are in favor of it, and what role does Congress have in determining whether all roles in the military will be open to women?
Well, we've had quite a few congresspeople step up in recent years. Representative Loretta Sanchez, Representative Jackie Speier have been two of the most vocal just on the House Armed Services Committee, and both have introduced various pieces of legislation, various amendments in recent years to try and force open those roles, usually in unsuccessful manners.
Those are both women. Is there a gender difference in the Congress?
There are some predictable falling along Democratic and Republican lines on a lot of these. Some folks who have previously served on both sides. I'm coming up with all women at the moment who on the Democratic side, but I know quite a few men have been vocal about it as well. But in terms of Congress's role in what this is going to be, I mean, Congress will. And Congress has a tendency to make a role for itself, even sometimes when it doesn't have one. So when this review comes out, if lawmakers are unhappy with this, they do have the annual authorization bills. They have a number of other pieces of legislation where they can request studies. They can look at this. We will almost undoubtedly see more investigations into whether or not standards are being lowered, whether or not there should be a uniform, both gender physical fitness standard, like Phil just said, and just how this will proceed.
Philip Carter, there's also, of course, from a political standpoint, a lot of pressure to on elected officials to get along with the military and be supportive of the military. But this goes both ways. What do you think is likely to happen, and how long do you think it's going to take to work this out?
I think the change has largely already happened. I mean, the biggest change were things like letting women into West Point and the Naval Academy, and that happened in 1976. And we've had stories of women on the front lines in Iraq and Afghanistan doing things, frankly, that are harder and more dangerous than Ranger School or serving in the infantry with more casualties for more than a decade now. And so I think that the deck chairs are largely set here, and we're simply watching kind of the last throes of this debate. The services will move forward with this, and they will implement both the president's will and the secretary's will, because ultimately the civilians are in charge of the military by constitutional design.
Leo Shane, in 1976 was a long time ago, and Congress does have a way of stretching out debates. Are you as optimistic as Philip Carter that this will be resolved sooner rather than later?
Well, I think we've seen this debate for quite a few years now. And again, last few years we have seen the Air Force and some of the other services really updating their policies, looking at these jobs and moving ahead. So will there be some positions, that will remain in debate for years to come, almost undoubtedly. But for most of this conversation, we've already seen it pass.
Leo Shane with the Military Times, Philip Carter with the Center for a New American Security, Anna Simons, professor at the Naval Postgraduate School, opposed to all jobs being available to women, Lajia Zeruto, major and combat veteran, hoping to go to Ranger School. Thank you all very much for being with us. To the Point, produced this week by Gideon Brower, Katie Cooper, Christine Detz, Benjamin Gottlieb, Jenny Hamill, Sarah Sweeney, and Paul Van Zielbauer. Our technical directors are Mike Newport and Joel Stein, our managing producer, Evan George. Thanks also to the John Coltrane family. I'm Orman Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.